Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, winner of every major award in its field. Today's guest on Meet the Press will be the new Attorney General, Nicholas DeBee Katzenbach. We'll bring you today's program in a moment.
Here is NBC Radio's Ray Shearer interviewing Congressman Barrett O'Hara of Chicago.
Congressman O'Hara, you are reported to be the oldest member of the House of Representatives. Where were you born and when?
I was born April 28, 1882, and I'm very proud that I am the oldest member of the House.
You meet all kinds of people on Sunday Night Monitor. This is Frank Blair suggesting you join us each Sunday night for news, information, and entertainment on NBC Radio.
Some of your best friends are rats. Every day, rats are helping to save your life through research in the laboratories where the war against cancer is being fought. Thanks to the use of rats, progress has been made in the diagnosis and treatment of this disease. To take full advantage of these advances, patients must get to their doctors in time. The earlier cancer is detected, the better the chances for cure. That's why it's so important to follow this advice from the American Cancer Society. Make yearly health checkups a way of living. Call your doctor to arrange for an appointment soon. You'll be giving yourself the best cancer protection possible. For further life-saving information, call your unit of the American Cancer Society. And remember, today there are 1,300,000 Americans who have been cured of cancer. To help cure more, give more when an American Cancer Society volunteer, your neighbor, calls on you. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest, the U.S. Attorney General Nicholas DeBee Katzenbach. Our panel consists of E.W. Kenworthy of the New York Times, James J. Kilpatrick of the Richmond News Leader, Lawrence E. Spivak, producer of Meet the Press, and Ron Nesson, NBC News. Ned Brooks is our moderator.
Our guest today on Meet the Press is Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach, the nation's chief law enforcement officer. He has played a leading role in the preparation of the Voting Rights Bill now before Congress. We'll have the first question now from Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel.
Mr. Katzenbach, you were quoted as saying you would oppose any major changes in the administration's voting rights bill. Do you think that any of the changes that have been proposed either by the House subcommittee or the Senate committee are major changes that might hurt the bill?
I think some of them might hurt the bill, Mr. Spivak, but I think the important point is that the essence of the president's bill, the guts, if I may say so, of that bill, remains in both the House and the Senate versions, and the changes have been, while they may be important, have been largely peripheral.
Are you opposed to any of the changes in either of the bills?
Yes, I am. I have reservations about the provision which was added to permit a state to get out when 60% of the voters had been registered in it. I'm sympathetic with the reasons for that. It was designed as an incentive to encourage a state to take care of its own problems. I am concerned about the particular language of it, and I am somewhat concerned about the provisions abolishing the poll tax by statute.
Well, do you think that any of those provisions might endanger the constitutionality of the law?
I think the provision on the poll tax raises a serious question as to that provision, and I've so testified. I think that it may be difficult to do that constitutionally. And I think more importantly than that, it may raise very serious practical problems should that be held unconstitutional.
Well, now, if that were in the bill, in the final bill, and it were held to be unconstitutional, would that make the whole bill unconstitutional?
No, only that provision would be unconstitutional.
But the rest of the bill would hold up?
Yes, I'm sure that it would.
Well, are you going to fight that proposal?
No, I'm not going to fight that proposal. I think the Senate and the House are going to work their will on this. I suspect there will be senators that will be concerned about it, and I think we'll see what happens in the Senate to that.
Well, is it fair to say then that you are willing to accept whatever version comes out of the House or the Senate or out of conference?
If that bill is going to do the job, and if it's similar to the bills that have been recommended in the House and in the Senate, it will do the job, and we would support those bills. And despite my views as to the poll tax, the Department of Justice would vigorously argue that case before the Supreme Court.
Now, Mr. Katzenbach, the new voting rights bill will outlaw literacy tests in 5 states. Don't you think that a federal law should apply equally to the citizens of all states?
Yes, I do, and this bill does.
How does it?
Because it applies to all the states, all 50 of the states, where these conditions in this bill are true, where there are literacy tests, where there are less than 50% voted in the last election, and where in the House version 20% of the citizens are non-white. Any states that meet those conditions, this bill applies to.
Well, isn't that really a device, though, to take care of the southern states? Isn't it true that there are a great many Puerto Ricans in New York today, for example, who can't pass the literacy tests and who can't vote and ought to vote?
I think they ought to vote. The literacy test there is an English language test. That's their problem, Mr. Spivak. But I think the aim of the bill is against discrimination. And in any state where there is discrimination, this bill will apply.
We'll continue the questions now with Mr. Kilpatrick.
Mr. Attorney General, at the time the administration's original bill was introduced on March 18, we were told how much time and preparation had gone into it and that it was then a very good bill. Is it not true, sir, that original bill has been scrapped and a completely new version has come out of both the House and the Senate?
No, that is not true, Mr. Kilpatrick. As I stated, the bill that came out of the House and the Senate is essentially and in its important provisions the same bill which the President set up to Congress, which had been worked on, as you'll recall, by members of both parties in both houses prior to his sending it up.
Well, the bill started out as 12 pages and 13 sections. It seems to have grown to 22 pages and 15 sections in the Senate version.
Yes.
This represents rather extensive rewriting, does it not, sir?
Yes, it represents that many more pages to the bill. The number of pages does not express the importance of the provisions, Mr. Kilpatrick.
In the original bill, the power of appointing or of providing for the examiners rested with the Attorney General. In the Senate bill, do I understand correctly that this now is to be done after or subject to a court proceeding?
In one section, that is true, and that is a section which was added by the Senate. The provisions which allowed the Attorney General to do this within the covered areas of the bill remain virtually intact in both the House and Senate versions.
You do have very serious doubts about the addition of this Section 9 in the Senate version, the poll tax section.
Yes, I do have serious doubts about it.
Will you recommend or take any more active part in asking that it be deleted?
I think that's difficult to know. One has to know the sentiment there. I expect that the bill will be further amended in some regards before it passes both houses of Congress. And it may be in the course of discussions in the Senate that the leadership may want the views of the Department of Justice, and if they do, I'd be happy to give them.
In the original bill, it was provided that if a man who had been registered by the federal examiner failed to vote over a period of 3 years, he would have to be dropped from the rolls. Why was that provision put in the original bill, Mr. Katzenbach, and why has it been dropped now?
Well, it was put in because we felt that if a person failed to vote normally in most states, he is dropped from the rolls. The provision that was changed just said that he should be dropped in accordance with whatever state law was, which seemed to be a more uniform, more easily administered provision.
Mr. Kenworthy.
Mr. Attorney General, there's a basic presumption behind this bill that where you have a literacy test, and where 50% of the people were not registered or voting in 1964, that this must be because of discrimination in the administration of the literacy test. Is that really a valid presumption?
Well, it raises what you describe as a presumption. I think that it is. And I think particularly when you add the fact that there's substantial non-white populations in those states, one wonders why in the voting in those states, number of voters was so much less than the national average. And one suggestion is that it might be because Negroes weren't being permitted to vote. When you find what states are included in that, and you find that it includes Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, you begin to suspect that maybe there is something to that presumption. But there's also a provision that allows them to get out from underneath that if they, in fact, haven't been discriminated.
But isn't it quite possible, really, that apathy, particularly in a one-party state, could result in fewer than 50% being registered or voting?
I think that's possible, and that's the reason that there's a provision in there that says if the reason wasn't discrimination, then you have an opportunity to show this. In fact, we even go further than that and say if the Attorney General has no reason to believe you've been discriminating, why, you're right out from under.
Well, wouldn't it be much easier? Relieve yourself of possible constitutional difficulties and make the bill more universal if you had a provision such as was suggested by Representative McCullough. Wherever you have petitions from 25 people who assert that they have been discriminated against, then the Attorney General can ask for registrars to be sent in. That would apply everywhere.
I think that would have been almost totally unworkable as a provision. And indeed, the bill, as it's passed in both the Senate and the House, does have a provision which says that also applies, a provision similar to that. But it goes
through a judicial determination, does it not?
Yes, but so does the suspension of literacy tests go through a judicial determination. And if, in fact, there's been discrimination, and we have a good deal of reason to believe that there has been, we've been working 4 years to establish it with some success within those areas, then I think that it's necessary to suspend for a period of time literacy tests, and that's all the bill does.
Mr. Nesson.
Mr. Katzenbach, do you think President Johnson's personal announcement of the arrest of the 4 Ku Klux Klan members in Mrs. Liuzzo's murder will impair their ability to get a fair jury trial?
No, I don't.
There's been a great deal of criticism, not only in Southern newspapers and by Southern politicians, but in the North, too, that this is pretrial judging of their guilt.
I thought the president was very careful in his statement to avoid precisely that, Mr. Nesson. He said that they would be promptly arraigned and be entitled to a fair trial. There was nothing in his statement anywhere that pointed to the guilt of these people apart from the fact that they had been arrested. What he was concerned about and what he wished to call national attention to, and what I think that President Johnson really had to call national attention to, was the fact that in incident after incident after incident of violence in the South, we have found this connected with Klan activity. And here was another incident where at least the people arrested were members of the Klan. And most of his statement, if you read it carefully, is aimed at the Klan. It's not aimed at these people that were arrested on this charge. And if they're innocent, then they'll have an opportunity to show that. I don't believe that they were prejudiced in any serious way by that statement. And I believe that there are times when the public importance of the issue far overshadows the more remote possibility that a person might conceivably be somewhat prejudiced in trial, because we have techniques to take care of that, to avoid that kind of prejudice.
Well, as it was, only 3 of the men were finally indicted. What happened to the 4th man?
The grand jury refused to indict the 4th man.
Well, did this man provide information on the other 3?
I'm not prepared to answer that question, Mr. Nesson. I can't tell you what went on within a grand jury room.
Has the FBI infiltrated the Klan?
Yes.
Well, Bobby Shelton...
At times, I think we know more about what the Klan is doing than I know what some of the divisions in the department are doing.
How many agents do you have in the Klan?
How many agents do we have in the Klan? I can't answer how many agents we have in the Klan. I wouldn't want to give the Klan that kind of information.
Are there agents you have in the Klan, or do you pay Klan members to provide...
It's mostly an informer system, and it's a very effective and good one.
The Imperial Wizard of the Klan in a news conference in Birmingham 2 weeks ago suggested that he had Klan members in the FBI. Is that true?
No.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Katzenbach, on this program several weeks ago, Dr. Martin Luther King said there are 2 types of laws, one just and one unjust, and that the individual has an obligation to disobey unjust laws and accept the penalty involved. Now, as the federal government's chief law enforcement official, will you give us your opinion on the right of the individual to determine for himself which laws he will obey and which he won't obey?
Well, Mr. Spivak, as the chief law enforcement officer, I don't think I'm particularly equipped to give an answer to an essentially moral question. As far as I'm concerned, all the laws are going to be enforced. As far as I'm concerned, anybody who breaks any laws is going to be brought to trial for breaking them. If an individual feels in his conscience that he must disobey a law that he regards as being unjust, that's not a philosophy that I've ever shared, and particularly in a democracy where government is by the consent of the government, where you have a voice in that. But if an individual feels that as a matter of religious or moral belief, I wouldn't be in a position to advise him that he should not do so.
No, I was just asking. I wasn't asking you to tell him what to do. Hmm. I was just asking your opinion as the chief law enforcement officer, what you think, what would happen in a country like this if there are many people who decided for themselves which laws were moral and which were not.
Well, I think we're fortunate in having a good many just laws, and I think we're fortunate in having a political system that allows people to get rid of unjust laws. And it does seem to me that that's relevant to the question as to whether laws are unjust or not, because in history and history of philosophy, the argument about not obeying the unjust law was almost always an argument against absolute power on the part of the governing body.
Well, see if you can answer this question. There are a great many people outside of the South who believe that civil disobedience by powerful leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King encouraged lawlessness across the country. Now, will you give us your opinion on that? Do you think that those sit-downs have encouraged lawlessness, that the demonstrations have encouraged lawlessness?
I don't think that they have in any very major way, Mr. Spivak. It seems to me always possible that demonstrations of this kind in the hands of responsible leaders such as Dr. King can then be used by others, sometimes younger people, sometimes less experienced, less thoughtful, and that you could encourage all the sort of activity that happened out at the University of California and that kind of thing.
Well, when the civil rights demonstrators demonstrated outside your office and sat down, as I remember it, you banned them and had them removed.
Yes.
Now, do you object to that, to sit-downs only when they're in front of your office or in your office, or do you object to them now on a general basis?
No, I don't object to sit-downs in various places. I objected to them outside my office. I'd object to them in the middle of Constitution Avenue. I think that form of demonstration can be governed, constitutionally governed by law, so that these activities can take place in reasonable circumstances as an expression of dissatisfaction. I got them out of my office because I was trying to get some work done.
Mr. Kilpatrick.
Mr. Attorney General, in less than 3 months, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 will become effective, making it unlawful for any employer of at least 100 persons to discriminate in his employment. What preparations are being made for the enforcement of Title VII when it becomes effective this summer?
Well, a good deal of preliminary preparation has been done on that by the President's Committee on Equal Employment Opportunity. The members of the commission have not yet been appointed, but I would anticipate their appointment very shortly. I would think it would be matter of days or a few weeks at the most. But we have been able to do a certain amount of helpful preliminary work to take account of the fact that the law does go into operation on July 2nd.
Under Section 707 of that act, when you determine that a pattern of discrimination exists, you have a responsibility to institute certain civil proceedings. And under that 1964 law, these are in the appropriate district court, that is, the local United States District Court.
Yes.
However, in your new voting rights bill of 1965, you get away from the idea of civil proceedings in the local United States District Court in favor of a three-judge court in Washington. Why is this?
Well, the statement, Mr. Kilpatrick, is only partially true. There are provisions in the pending bill, very important provisions, which do go to the local courts.
These are the criminal provisions?
No, the criminal provisions, yes, and all of the provisions with respect to where 20 or more people complain that there's been discrimination and the Attorney General institutes a suit. The only section of the Act that comes to the three judge court in the district is that section which suspends literacy tests in the absence of a showing that they haven't been used for discriminatory purposes.
Do you regard this as a vital part of the bill, a vital provision that it be before the three-judge court in Washington?
No, I don't regard that as a vital provision. I think it's a useful provision. I think it will help to get uniformity and of decision. I think it will help to speed up decisions. I don't regard it as the absolute essence of the bill.
Aren't you shopping around for a favorable forum?
No.
Didn't you testify, though, sir, that you were dissatisfied with the course of justice in some of the United States District Courts in the South?
No, No, I never testified to that. I've never criticized the judiciary anywhere. As I said, one of the problems that we have is there's been a good deal of delay in civil rights cases. And in part, this may be explained by a crowded docket.
You lost a couple of cases, too, isn't
it? We haven't lost any case yet, Mr. Gilpatrick. We've lost a couple in the lower courts, but
we
have yet
to
lose one on appeal.
Yes, but you did lose them in the lower United States District Courts.
Yes, and in those cases, we're reversed. Every one that we've lost has been reversed by the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Kenworthy.
Mr. Attorney General, I'd like to get back to that amendment by Mr. Dirksen that caused you so much trouble last Thursday and Friday. That is the amendment that would allow the states to come out from under the automatic coverage when they had 60% of their total voting age population registered. Mr. Dirksen said this was to provide an incentive for them. But what states would it have taken out immediately?
Well, it would have taken out, I think, Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina, and I would suppose that by the time the bill became effective, it would have taken out the remainder.
You mean that they would quickly have registered whites?
Well, they have a few whites left to register. They don't have any whites left to register in some counties. They've got 110, 115% of the whites already registered. But in those counties where they're only up to 80 or 90%, they would register them, and they'd register some Negroes and get up to 60%.
Well, before the day was over, a compromise was reached. A new provision added that the state or county not only had to have 60% registered, but the court also had to determine that they were not discriminating. Was that acceptable to you now?
I think that's helpful, Mr. Kenworthy.
But not acceptable?
It's not totally acceptable because you run to the difficulty of what it means to say they're not presently discriminating. Now, if that means that they haven't discriminated in the past 6 months or year or 2 years or something of that kind, then it might possibly be acceptable.
Gentlemen, we have 3 minutes remaining. Mr. Nesson.
Mr. Katzenbach, does the economic boycott of Alabama proposed by Martin Luther King violate any law?
I doubt that it does, Mr. Nesson, but it's very hard to say because Dr. King has been very vague about exactly what it was he proposed to do. The antitrust provisions, which I suppose is what you have in mind, have always been aimed at monopolizing competition where you have an economic motive for the restraint or for the monopoly, and have never been extended by any court decisions to date to include something which might restrain competition, but where the motive was purely a moral or religious one of that kind. Now, of course, it's possible for that nonetheless to apply. It's possible to try to disguise an economic motive and pretend that it's a moral one. But so far, it looks to me something like, the sort of thing that is done by various groups when they say, don't see this moving picture, it's indecent or obscene, or don't listen to this singer, she's a former Nazi, that kind of boycott, and we've never found that to be within the antitrust law.
Well, Harry Bridges, Longshoremen's Union already has refused to unload some products from Alabama. Now, would that fall within labor laws preventing boycotts?
Well, I took it that, although it's hard to believe that Mr. Bridges was doing this for moral reasons and not for economic ones, that he was doing it in support of Dr. King, and he also said he didn't know of any Alabama products they ever had unloaded anyhow.
Aside from the legal aspects, though, do you think the boycott would antagonize race relations and hurt innocent people, or do you favor it?
I would think it would be very difficult to have a boycott of that kind that did not hurt innocent people. I ought to say generally that I'm strongly for economic development in these states to give everybody a better opportunity, and that's the range of the long future.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Katzenbach, last month President Johnson called crime a national problem and promised a national attack on it. Can you tell us what steps the Justice Department has taken?
Yes, we've introduced some legislation in this respect already, principally a law assistance act to help local law enforcement agencies, and we've introduced some legislation with respect to organized crime. We've also been making recommendations to the President as to the commission which he intends to appoint, and some further suggestions on what that commission should be studying and recommending about.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Attorney General Katzenbach, for being with us today on Meet the Press.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. In just a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview. The Federal Bar Association reminds us that freedom depends on the rule of law. The law protects you. Respect it. Uphold it. Obey it. And here to help promote respect for the law and for those who enforce it is Governor Carl Sanders of Georgia.
From every source today, we hear much of the rights of men. Property rights and rights arising out of our citizenship cannot be exercised freely or properly except in an environment of law. The law can thrive and be effective only in an atmosphere of enthusiastic observation and mutual respect for the right of others. Indifference to the law, however, is not merely a symptom of poor citizenship. It is a dangerous and sometimes fatal community infection. I believe the only way to enjoy and derive the benefits of our rights in a free society is to observe and respect the law at all times. We have created our own laws through our own actions, as well as through the activities of our elected representatives. I urge all citizens to resolve today to adopt law observance as a personal creed and thereby set an outstanding example of good citizenship for all to see.
You have just heard, pre-recorded, Governor Carl Sanders of Georgia speaking in behalf of the Federal Bar Association in support of its law enforcement program. Now, more details on Meet the Press. Today's guest was Attorney General Nicholas DeBee Katzenbach, and the panel consisted of James J. Kilpatrick of the Richmond News Leader, Ron Nesson, NBC News, E.W. Kenworthy of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, producer of Meet the Press. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkle Press, 809 Channing Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C. Let me tell you about Tom. He's 20 years old, was born in 1941, the year U.S. Savings Bond Program started. Tom goes to college now, and savings bonds put him there. You see, Tom's dad bought Series E savings bonds regularly for 20 years, not large bonds, just a $25 bond every month. Can you guess how much Tom's father saved and earned through savings bonds? Over $6,000. How would you like to have that much when your child is ready for college? You can if you start now and buy savings bonds. They're a better investment today than ever. They pay higher interest, they mature faster. You get $4 back for every three in just 7 years, 9 months. During 1961, America is celebrating the 20th anniversary of U.S. savings bonds. People like Tom's father have been buying savings bonds that long. It's a proven way to save and have. It works. Meet the Press will be heard again next week at the same time, when our guest will be the governing mayor of Berlin, Willy Brandt, who will be visiting this country next week. He is chairman of the Social Democratic Party of Germany and is his party's candidate for chancellor in the national election to be held this year. NBC Monitor News next on the NBC Radio Network.